Hello everyone and welcome to the Wednesday edition of The Daily Friend. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, standing in for Cecilia Ngubesi, who is travelling the Northern Cape at the moment. Or I believe KZN. I'm joined today with my colleagues, Mr. Herman Pretorius, a campaign coordinator at the IRR. Herman, how are you this afternoon?
I am well, thanks. And yourself, Nick?
I'm very well, thank you. And Mr. Terence Corrigan, our project manager. Terence, how are you today?
I'm well, thanks, Nicholas. It's been an interesting couple of days.
Yes, it has been indeed. But we'll talk about, I think we've got a couple of quite interesting topics here today. So I'll start off with Herman taking the lead here, which is that Moody's review of our
credit rating
is imminent. And there's a lot of speculation about what their move is going to be. Herman, what have you
said? Yeah. Well, of the three main credit rating agencies, Standard & Poor's, Fitch, and Moody's, Moody's is the only one still to have us at investment grade. In other words, not junk status is the casual term. Interestingly, since 1994, Moody's has never had us at junk status. Standard & Poor's and Fitch have. And we are, according to them, back into so-called junk status. But Moody's has been resisting this downgrade. Now, I've heard from some people that it's very much a political consideration and an ideological reasoning on the part of Moody's, there might be some truth in that, but it's difficult to speak to with any level of certainty. But Renaissance Capital have they have recently called 8 out of 9 credit rating calls correctly. They are of the opinion that Moody's will, with its next review at the beginning of November, downgrade South Africa's credit rating to junk status. Now, that would come as no surprise, seeing as the other two main rating agencies have done so already. But the reasons Renaissance Capital give are basically that the fiscal situation is poor, the economic situation is poor. Politically, President Ramaphosa seems unable to bring about any reforms, especially things like privatization and the cutting of the state's payment to government employees and state employees, hamstrung by political considerations, by the unions, all that. So all of this culminates in this necessity, basically, according to Renaissance Capital. And the Center of Risk Analysis, they agree that a downgrade is quite likely. And we'll have to see what happens. There are quite a few repercussions if that happens, but we can get into that.
So, Terence, it seems like one of the causes of this worsening financial situation is the big hole that is caused by Eskom's dire financial situation. We were talking a little bit about Modipo and Kusile today,
right?
And it's the drain they've had. What's your take on that?
Yeah, look, I think there's a variety of things. One of which is that we don't really have an economic policy to speak of. Mm-hmm. A foundation of a modern economy is a reliable source of power, and that started to give out around a decade ago. Modupi and Kusile were supposedly our intermediate fixes. We are sitting massively over budget, I think factor of 2 or 3 by now. There's concerns about the engineering. So, you know, you might find that when squeezed, they produce a refreshing glass of lemonade.
I read actually there was one of the engineers and consultants who was brought in to look at these power plants said that they needed to do a complete reset on them because the design was so flawed.
So I've heard. You know, one wonders just what we got for all that money. Evidently not very much. Look, you know, I think that the whole electricity supply system over the next couple of decades has to be kind of reconfigured. Privatization, I think, is sooner or later going to be inevitable. But I think, you know, beyond that, looking at diversifying sources of electricity, I think you're going to, what you are seeing more and more in suburban communities is people going off grid, you know, solar power or whatever. One of those areas where relentless capitalist opportunity and green politics might actually make
that's for you, Kathy.
make for useful allies.
But Terence, on that, perhaps I could ask, what would be if such a movement of let's call it micro privatization of energy sources, if that continues, what or in fact accelerates, what's the effect of that on municipalities and the incomes of municipalities?
Well, it's not good. Given the extent that to which they're reliant on utility fees alongside their rates, but if our governance systems or our governance practices were up to scratch, that's something that you can build for and you can plan, and you understand that, you know, you're simply not going to be getting massive amounts of money for this, or there's going to be a substantial drop. I'm old enough to remember when you had to get things like license discs for your bicycle or license discs for your dog. As far as I'm aware, those are no longer required.
Where did you put the license disc on the dog?
You needed to go to the municipal offices once a year, and you got like a little slip or something, which was your dog license.
And people say the National Party were capitalists.
And for your bicycle, you got this little metal disc that you attached onto the
handlebar.
No, onto the wheel, onto the.
I think I've seen them. Yes.
Yeah. That was something you didn't. You could be inspected. In fact, I remember that the municipality took a great interest in people's pets, because every so often, at pickup time, a police car used to come with a siren advising everyone to go and have their pets vaccinated. We don't have that sort of dog tax anymore, but
they might come back. It seems, because surely surely the government thinks it has spent these billions of rands on these power stations. I can't see any way they save face if they were to grant this level of micro-privatization and make it as easy as possible, taking into account the negative effects that might have on the gravy train.
I don't think the government has a lot of opportunity to save face anymore, because
that's very much gone.
You know what hurts your standing in the world more than that is having your electricity grid collapse.
Yes.
Yeah.
How close?
Look, I have to believe that we haven't quite crossed, you know, the sort of river Styx yet. So I'm hoping that we can just look forward to continual blackouts. The sort of massive zombie apocalypse, end of the world as we know it, grid collapse, you know, where we're sort of shooting out over the last tin of baked beans and what was the shop right. I think generally that's seen as unlikely, but no longer impossible.
And it will highlight economic inequalities, because a lot of people who can afford to make alternative arrangements will probably be able to do so, but then the poorer areas will, as we see now with things like healthcare, just deteriorate into rubble.
And just to close on this. So going back to the original thing, which is the ratings downgrade, how likely, Herman, do you think it is that this looming or possibly looming downgrade has been priced in by investors already?
Sure. That's actually quite difficult. I don't know if I could answer that with any great confidence.
What's your gut feeling tell you?
My gut feeling is pretty much yes. I think it has been priced in. That explains a lot of the outflow of equity, the capital outflows out of the country, and So I think it has been priced in. That's part of why we're doing so badly. But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that can only really change with a change in economic policy. Mm. And speaking of Eskom,
the adoption of an economic policy.
The creation, the adoption, the implementation of an economic policy. Shout out to Tito Mboweni's plan. But if we're going to look at bash these two stories together with the elegance of the Large Hadron Collider, Moody's themselves said that Eskom's financial stability will in the future play a very, very, very large role in ratings considerations. So if they... because earlier this year they surprised the investment community a bit and the analysts by saying that they are not... they're not changing our outlook from stable to negative. But they said that is very much dependent on the financial stability of Eskom. So if we're going to look at the power producer at Eskom's, you know, dire situation of more than 400 billion rands in debt, I mean, it seems to culminate in a crisis on many, many levels. And we at the Institute have said that Eskom's capacity basically caps any possible economic growth for this country at 2%.
All right. Well, we're going to move on now to something that's going on in the world of tech and international affairs. The large computer gaming company, Blizzard Activision, which is famous for games from World of Warcraft to Call of Duty, some of the most recognizable franchises in gaming in the gaming world. They run a game called Hearthstone, which is a card game online, and they have big tournaments for this video game. One of the winners of these tournaments for their Hong Kong tournament, in a post-match interview, ended by putting on a sort of mask like the Hong Kong protesters wear and shouted, "Liberate Hong Kong," at which point the two people interviewing him over the internet ducked under their tables and they kind of awkwardly closed down the stream. In response to the fear of potential Chinese state backlash to Blizzard, the Chinese government has been known to ban companies that endorse policies they don't like. The casters, the people interviewing him, were fired, both of them. He was kicked out of the tournament, and all of his prize money was confiscated. And this has now erupted into a little sort of online battle where a lot of people are criticizing the company for bending the knee, basically, to the Chinese state. But this speaks to a larger theme, which is that across the whole world, you're seeing a lot of media being heavily influenced by reliance on the Chinese market. So, for example, the movie Red Dawn, the remake in 2012, was originally going to be about a Chinese invasion of the United States that sort of takes the United States by surprise. over fears that this would hurt them in the Chinese market or get the film banned in Chinese theater, state theater, controlled movie theaters, the movie at the last minute changed everything to be a reference to North Korea rather than China.
That's slightly racist.
Yes.
They kind of look the same. Let's just roll with it.
Right. Exactly.
If that's the solution, then the problem's quite huge.
It seems like it's a growing concern for a lot of people that the reliance on the gigantic Chinese market, which is now, you know, coming into the world due to China's large economic growth, is giving the Chinese state an enormous lever of economic power over the world. Terence, you've spent a lot of time in Asia. What do you think the ramifications of this are?
Well, I think fundamentally you're correct that there's a great deal of kowtowing, if you'll forgive the phrase. In the 1990s, you had movies like Red Corner, like 7 Years in Tibet, Kundun, you know, all that dealt with this. I wondered the extent to which they would be possible now. Certainly, I think people who have some sort of aspiration of getting into that market. We've also seen, actually, just last week too, apparently references to South Park have been scrubbed from the internet in China because they took up this theme. I think, you know, particularly, you know, for those of us who value personal freedom, South Park is a very, very good is a very good barometer, because they get it. And I'm reminded of what the character Kyle said at one point: either it's all okay or none of it is. Mm. He was talking there about the Muhammad cartoon, mm. And that became an issue for them as well. But I think also, you know, there's maybe a moment here for some introspection on the part of that artistic community that often trumpets how brave and transgressive they are. You know, when dealing with the leadership of a democracy, we're dealing with a Trump or a Boris Johnson. Steadfastness, commitment to principle seems to crumble very, very quickly when you're dealing with, if I may put it this way, the real video nasties.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, no, I can't remember who said the famous quote, I don't care who writes a nation's laws, let me write its songs. And this, I hope Hong Kong can kind of be remind countries like the UK and like America and anyone really who buys into the idea of liberty and classical liberalism, that these freedoms actually manifest somehow. They are often taken for granted. I think there's a huge complacency oftentimes, and Hong Kong with this, with video games now being an implement, a tool of oppression, that just shows that once you sell the principle of freedom, as Terence quoted Kyle.
Kyle, yes.
Yes, that one. Once you compromise on that principle,
philosopher,
to give the government powers over these kind of forms of expression, I mean it's dangerous. It never ends well.
So one of the sort of, it looks like there's an emerging response to this, though, that's kind of coming from ordinary people, which is calls for economic boycotts of the companies that do kowtow to the Chinese state's sort of censorship policies. I'm going to start with Herman. Do you think that this is ever going to really manifest, or do you think it's just more sort of Twitter noise?
Well, that's what... I genuinely, this might sound very cynical, but I think it's unlikely to manifest. Things like slavery wasn't ended through economic pressure. And that's the kind of the measurement, I think, is you check how moral is a society by what it is willing to pay for and where it wants to save money. Child labor, slavery, all these kind of things that were economically beneficial moral evils. So money talks, and if these people are, I wish they would prove me wrong. I really hope they prove me wrong, but I think there's a convenience has settled world globally that we are too married to these products and services that we can cheaply buy instead to really take principle and feel those principles in our pockets, and I think that's actually quite sad.
Terence, do you think it's going to happen, an economic boycott? Or do you think it's a good idea, rather?
Look, I'm ambivalent. I think that something is a good idea to the extent that it can have an impact. If you look back, South Africa was the cause célèbre of various interest groups in the 70s and 80s. They could inflict damage. You know, things like particularly the refusal to grant credit was very damaging. But you know, I think one can overplay the sort of moral dimension of that. I think Frederick Gonzalez-Slobbert once remarked that one of the impacts of the sanctions campaign wasn't so much firms with big interests pulling out, but it was those with relatively minor interests in South Africa spending a disproportionate amount of time justifying that, and it became a liability that they didn't need. But then again, you know, let's also bear in mind that there were plenty of people willing to do business with South Africa on the sly, remember reading an account about Norwegian ships, you know, taking down their flags before they sailed in the Cape Town harbor because that wasn't going to look so good. And apparently there were all sorts of strange deals being done with, you know, countries that resolutely refused to recognize the racist regime in South Africa. I think the Chinese were actually involved there. I think, though, that you know, if you are going to try and make a moral point out of it, then you have to be consistent, because moral judgments by their nature have to be consistent and universal. Mm. So, you know, I have I've raised this a couple of times with, for instance, the magazine affiliated with my church, which I, you know, essentially don't buy anymore because of I just think of too many moral double standards there. They had an editorial calling for a boycott of Israel, and I said, yes, but our church is actually essentially an illegal entity in China, yet I've never seen a single article calling for any sort of action there.
Economic boycott of China.
Well, yes, and I wonder if you know, if I went through the editorial offices, how many products made in China I would see, you know. Yes, you know, and I think that there's a word for that, and it's hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. You know, we, you know, either, as I say, you know, all oppression is okay, or it's all wrong. I think, though, that there is a pragmatic argument. You know, do we let's say that pressure would conceivably, you know, manifest in some sort of economic damage for China. Does that cause the government to liberalize or to concede to it or to crack down harder?
Yeah,
I mean, this was once again, this was also something that Van Zyl Slabbert said. Mm-hmm. So that it was often assumed that if you can inflict damage, that's going to be the outcome. He says there was always a danger that things could just, you know, sort of get out of hand. And he said that was the problem with a lot of the strategies to oppose apartheid. Not whether there are moral or political arguments, but whether the real world consequences would be positive. Mm-hmm. And from that flowed his opposition, for instance, to the use of violence, because it makes those outcomes far less predictable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if by doing this you are let's say harming the mobility of China's emerging middle class, do they see this as, well, you know, we need to sort of join that liberal consensus, or do they or is the reaction nationalist that somehow, you know, these imperialists are trying to, you know, are trying to cheat us? Mm. It's a very, very difficult question, and I think my final word in it is from Richard Nixon, who I think writing in the late 1980s said that. You know, at that with Asia's economic growth, he was talking about China, Vietnam, whatever. He said our lecturing them about democracy and human rights now might be annoying. He says, in 10 years it'll be ill advised, and you know, in 20 years time it'll be laughable. That you know, I think there is something to be said for that. Hmm. Of course, if what one is doing is, you know, making a statement that makes oneself feel good, I don't see anything wrong with that.
Fair enough. All right, and I think we'll close on a slightly happier story involving the American TV presenter and comedian Ellen DeGeneres, who was recently photographed at the Cowboys Dallas game, football game in the U.S., with a slightly surprising guest. Terrence, why don't you tell us about it?
Right. Ellen DeGeneres, as she describes herself, a gay Hollywood liberal, was not only photographed, but filmed herself on her selfie with none other than former President George W. Bush, in fact, sitting next to each other.
And smiling.
Yeah, and they seem to be having a great old time together.
You guys.
And she was attacked on social media about this, you know, how could you and whatever.
Wait, Terrence, are you saying that people are upset on social media?
You know, it's a funny thing, you know,
heard about this.
One enters the jungle at one's peril. And she said, you know, I think she made a comment, well, people do what they do on social media. They tweeted outrage. Said, yeah, well, you know, actually she gets on quite well with George Bush. He's a funny guy, and, you know, he's It doesn't have horns. Bit of a hooky nose, but he is losing his hair. Apparently socially very flexible, and she said she's friends with a lot of people who disagree, and the point that she made, in broadcast, and I think this was very meaningful. It says, when I say be kind, I mean be kind to everyone, not to people you agree with. Mm. Now it's interesting. You can actually go online and you can find an interview that she did in her show with George W. Bush 2 years ago. So this isn't something that's
convenient in the moment.
Yeah, you know, her show is not deep politics. But she seemed to be having a good time. It was a very human conversation, and George Bush was in office, a very polarizing figure. Some people loved him, some people hated him. I think it does help to remind us that there is a three-dimensional person. Ellen DeGeneres has also been a lightning rod for a lot of anger. There's a three-dimensional person there. And I think actually going one step further, George Bush and Michelle Obama apparently get on famously.
Yes.
And in fact, Ellen DeGeneres asked George Bush, says, Obama, are you as close to Barack Obama as to his wife? He said, well, he's never given me a hug like she is. I really wish, there's a certain old school charm about that.
Mm.
That you may not agree, you may even disagree on some very fundamental things, but that doesn't make you a monster.
Mm. And I think that's also what the IRR, that's a lot of what we mean with, unite the middle, the common sense, decent, middle of the road South African. Yeah. There is, for some reason, we've fallen into this trap of, on social media at least, thinking that anyone who disagrees with me on the problems or the solutions, they are monstrous, they are evil. It's not that they
must be destroyed.
Yes, it's not that you can just disagree or you can have the most fiery debate about issues. It is that if someone disagrees with you, and this happens on all ends of the political spectrum, if someone disagrees with you, it is because they are evil. And I must say, I things like this, it just reminds me that that's absolute nonsense. And I like to think that South Africans have the same appreciation that, we're all people, we're all individuals, and we all appreciate it to be treated, not tweeted as such, but help both.
Well, actually, if I can just, I generally keep out of discussions of foreign politics, but I have noticed actually that this sort of cross-aisle cooperation is something that elder statesmen try to engage in. George Bush's father and Bill Clinton, although they were quite fierce opponents, got together in their later years.
Got on famously, great friends.
Yeah, what's his name? Ronald Reagan and the House Speaker, O'Neill.
Tip
O'Neill. Yes, they were apparently able to look beyond
the politics.
Beyond their differences, and closer to home, I remember once being told that banks were very surprised to meet Joe Slovo. So there was someone who they could actually talk to, and you sort of understood that, well, money is not endless, apparently many in the industry were deeply, deeply distressed when he went. Not just because they found him a nice guy, but because they actually found him someone that they could do business with. Strange things can happen if one only believes.
On a last note, I think one of my favorite incidents of history is when Gorbachev met Thatcher for the first time before becoming the leader of the USSR, and her judgment of the man was, this is someone I can do business with. And famously, apparently, she opened the meeting, her first meeting with Gorbachev, and said, Mr. Gorbachev, I despise communism and everything it stands for. And from that point on, they knew where they stood with each other. Mm. And they had the ideological clarity that they weren't on the same page ideologically, but that human connection, that Thatcher got along with Gorbachev, that Thatcher told Reagan that this is someone we can do business with, acknowledging the humanity of another individual quite possibly ended the Cold War.
And on that note of wisdom and human clarity, I'd like to say thank you for listening to us. If you like the work that the Institute of Race Relations does, you can SMS your name to 32823. SMSs cost R1, and terms and conditions apply. And we'll see you on the next edition of The Daily Friend.